All right, we're back. Another episode of Spirit of the Game. This is Ed May with
Lewis Harry.
And we're here to chat about the rules as we like to do it. It's Masters Week. It's the 5th of April, Tuesday, kind of the tweener day. Tomorrow we have the par three, of course, and then the games begin. Oh, isn't that great? Aren't you excited?
I guess you could say the games have already begun with the women's amateur and drive to putt this past weekend.
No, that's true. It's really a fun run up. And of course, Jennifer Kupcho, having won the first Anlaw, now bookends that with the last Dinosaur, as we'll call it.
I believe you called that early last week.
It's amazing. Here's my theory on calls. If you make enough of them every once in a while, you'll get it right. And I predicted she's been going to win every week for the last 3 years, so I finally got it right. But no, we're going to talk this week about the top five Masters rulings of note. And full disclosure, this was a cheater. This was a Google-inspired list. I'm not sure I would agree with the list, but they're certainly, I think, definitely got it's the right. They're right. They're pretty notable. So we're going to start in the classic countdown method with number five and work our way to number one. So number five was Ernie Els's piled for removal drop on hole 11 in 2004. And this one is actually one I know quite well because at the time, Will Nicholson, who's a former CGA board member and former chair of the Masters Rules Committee, made this ruling. So that particular year, there was a serious ice storm that knocked down a lot of limbs. And they literally were scrambling to get the golf course ready for play. And a bunch of limbs had come down and they were piled up way left of hole 11. Ernie Els hits it way left, kind of a duck hook. The rules official there at the time was a tour official. I can't remember his name, denied Ernie relief, said, no, you're not going to get relief. And by the way, I should back up. When material is piled for removal, that is by definition ground under repair and you're entitled to relief. If it's just dumped there and it's just going to sort of biodegrade like grass clippings that are dumped way, way back, no relief. But material that's there temporarily for removal, by definition, is ground under repair. So the official there on the spot said no, called for a second opinion. It happened to be Will Nicholson, who was the buck stops here guy, pulls up in a cart. I was watching on television and he granted him relief. And Els was able to take free relief, no penalty, did not have to declare it unplayable, and ended up making a miraculous five, which looked like it would have been much worse. Ended up, I think, finishing second by a stroke. So if he had won, I think number five on our list might go to number one on our list. So again, in terms of retrospective, how has that rule changed today?
Well,
if at all.
So if at all, so the thing you got to think about today, if Ernie Els hits that same shot today, or let's just say, fast forward to this weekend, Ernie Els hits that shot. It's very well that he could get a similar ruling from an official, and it's very well he could get a similar ruling from the first official, but material piled for removal being ground under repair. I kind of like what you said. If there's something that's just dumped there, it's not necessarily ground and repair. There's many courses across the country, and Augusta National is no different, that limbs and construction material and things that they've removed from the golf course just get dumped out of sight. And
well, that's funny you say that, not to interrupt you, because that's exactly what Will Nicholson said to contradict what you just said. We don't leave material piled for removal at Augusta. That is piled for removal. It was like, unlike every other course in America, we don't do what every other course does. There's no such thing. So that's really how he justified the ruling.
Yeah. So, and with Ernie, in that scenario, with him being so far left there on number 11, it could be a likely spot that it could have been left there and not been prepared for removal. It's personally, I probably would consider something like that piled for removal and be considered ground and repair there for a reason. You mentioned with the ice storm that limbs had fallen all over the place. There was damage to trees that had been and, maintenance staff had been scrambling to fix that or get it removed from the golf course. So, me personally, I am on Ernie L's side here. I think in that scenario, I would agree that even today, I would agree that that would have been piled for removal.
Well, Will Nicholson is smiling down on you, Lewis, from upon high in golf heaven. One thing about his ruling that I'll have to say is a lesson to rules officials. There was no doubt in his mind. It was a definitive. We don't leave material pile for removal, Augusta. You get relief. It wasn't hemming and hawing, and he wasn't combing through the rule book or calling on the radio. He knew it was his decision to make, and he did not wait 1 second longer than needed. And he got a fair amount of criticism for it because it looked bad. It looked like this guy's hit it into no man's land, and he's getting out of jail free. And Will did say, by the way, he hit an incredible shot because his relief was not very good. He had a tiny little window to get out of, and he hit this incredible punch draw to hit it through that window. Frankly, I think you could argue that if he had gone back to the tee, he probably would have had a better option because he was taking a big chance by dropping where he did.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, anywhere there on the left side of 11, whether you get relief or not, you're still not getting the best shot into that green. And like you said, you know, criticism or not, you know, in that scenario, the first official that denied the relief, you know, you got to think on his part, you know, how does he feel after that ruling that, you know, kind of overruled in a way, and maybe, you know, he feels that maybe he gave the bad ruling at first and was corrected or kind of stepped on.
I had the good fortune of serving on the rules committee at the Masters for 3 years, and I learned kind of the ins and outs of how the pecking order works. And on hole 14, round one, on one of the years, the wind was blowing crazy. And by the way, the way they assign rules officials at the Masters, which is now the same procedure used by, I think, still used by the Open Championship, but definitely not by the USGA, used to be, you know, where you walk with a group. So frankly, as a rules official, it's more fun to walk with a group because you get to see the whole course and watch great golf. When you're assigned to a hole, you don't get that wonderful opportunity to see the whole golf course. But what I learned in that particular year, I think it was 2017, was wind was blowing really hard. And I can't remember, I think it was Corey Pavin, if you can believe that, was in the field. And I think it was even Fred Couples, hit their balls in the top tier of 14, and the wind blew them all the way off while they were walking up off of the green. And I, not knowing the pecking order, got on the radio and called for Mark Russell, who is a PGA Tour rules official, who I knew by reputation and a little bit from meeting him, that he seemed to me, he was the backside rover, that he was the right person to call. Well, Mark never answered on the radio. And a few minutes later came over and said, Ed, first of all, they're not going to suspend play here. If it was a tour event, they might consider it. So try to do me a favor. Don't make yourself look stupid on the radio again. Number one. So I know it's happening. We're aware of it. But because I was just calling in, hey, balls are blowing off the green. I think this is something somebody should be aware of. And I was joking about your Motorola rights instead of your Miranda rights. Anything you say can and will be held against you when you get on that radio. And he said, and secondly, that's a Jim Heiler call. At the time, Jim was kind of his direct. And so this is when Fred Ridley was the chair of the competition committee. So anyway, my point was, I did two things wrong. Number one, I thought this is a problem. No. And number two, I called the wrong guy. So at any rate, I wasn't at all offended because everybody who's there understands that you're in a different universe when you're working the Masters. All right. Moving on to number four, staying local. Dal Finsterwald, longtime head professional at the Broadmoor. This happened in 1960. And he, I think it said on hole, and I wasn't familiar with this. I looked it up. It was either hole 11 or hole 12, dropped his ball on the green after he'd holed out and hit a couple practice putts. Billy Casper, who was playing with him, said, Dow, I think that's a problem. Dow, who really knew the rules well and was very, very meticulous, I'm sure, was shocked because that wasn't something that he would do. But he pointed out by local rule, practice putting after holing out was prohibited. Is that still true today?
It is still true today. Under a rule, I believe it's 5.5A, it talks about where we're permitted to practice on the golf course during play. Today, under the 2019 rules of golf, Today, we're permitted to practice after a hole has been completed. We're allowed to roll practice putts on the green of the hole just completed, or chip and putt near on the next practice tee. That's permitted under the rules of golf. Rule 5.5A, I believe that's the correct sub-rule that permits it. However, there's a model local rule that prohibits where we're allowed to practice, when we're allowed to practice, and most of that is during the play of a competition. A lot of high-level golf uses that model local rule to prohibit practice on the golf course during play. I know the PGA Tour, I believe, has that model local rule in their conditions of competition. Masters probably has that model local rule in their conditions of competition on their and on their notice to competitor sheet. So that, even if Dow Finsterwald was playing in the 2022 Masters by some miracle,
I don't know. He's still with us.
So
he could.
So if he was playing and he rolled some practice putts by that model local rule prohibiting that practice, he would still be penalized.
So what do you think this is about? Why do we care? Talk about why practice on the – what the overarching sort of principle is but behind practicing – during the competition. First of all, that's pretty weird. Can you imagine a football team saying timeout, running a few scrimmage drills during the game? Why is that allowed at all?
Well, I always equate it, and I've used this equation before. It would almost be like if there was a timeout in a basketball game, and instead of one team, you know, taking their timeout, they stayed on the floor and shot hoops during the timeout. It would be weird, right? The crowd would be like, what are they doing?
Right,
you
know, right.
You know, why aren't they taking a timeout? It would almost be like that. But the core of practicing during a competition, you know, when we're talking about on a golf course, a lot of that practicing is, you know, either to gain information about a putt that was just hit, you know, about the way a green is rolling, or, you know, the way, you know, your club's going through, you know, certain turf, if you're chipping near the next teeing area, a lot of it's to gain information mm-hmm. about a stroke. Right. And I think the argument can be, well, if you're practicing on a putting green that was just completed, well, you're not gaining information for any upcoming strokes because you just completed that, but you're still gaining information about how the ball is rolling, about how your putting stroke is, you know, mm-hmm. on a certain day. So there's still some information to be gained there by practicing during a competition.
But now, in fairness, you could drop a ball down on the next green or on the next tee, I'm sorry, even though it's not rolling at the speed, you're not mm-hmm. testing, getting any real good feedback. But in terms of the fundamentals of your stroke, you could certainly do that.
You could still, yeah, you could
that
still.
That would look weird too. Mm-hmm. What about if you're in the middle of the hole? You're on the, so Vijay Singh, I think this happened. You're on, not at the Masters, but you're in the middle of the play of the fifth hole. And there's a green group on the green and you're waiting and you drop a couple balls in the fairway and start working on hit a couple putts.
Yep. You're going to get penalized.
That's going to be a penalty.
That's going to be a penalty.
Because that does not apply. It's just a very, very specific.
Yep. So the way 5.5A reads is that when we're practicing, there's only that limited bubble of where we can make a practice stroke during a competition. That's on the putting green of the hole just completed, or on or near the next teeing area of the hole to be played. Right. If we drop a ball in the middle of the fairway, we make a practice stroke, we're going to get a penalty stroke because of that. Oddly enough, if we make a practice swing and we hit a pine cone in the middle of a hole, we're not going to get penalized for hitting that pine cone because under the rules, making a stroke at a pine cone or other similar natural object doesn't count as a practice stroke.
Okay.
Weirdly enough as well, if we hit a ball back to a practice area, also doesn't count as a practice stroke.
Right.
If we're doing it as a courtesy yeah. to remove that ball from play or to hit a ball back to another player.
One of the things I've always stuck with me is there was a decision back when the decisions book was around that was I referred to as the casually flicking decision, where that was the words used in the decision where a player is backhanding kind of with one hand, bag on their shoulder, on one shoulder, hitting one-arm shots, casually flicking balls back into the tidying up the course, and the decision was no harm, no foul. But it is weird. I've never really thought about your example of a basketball game. Timeout, players go out there shooting hoops and having fun. So it really is an odd thing. And I guess it all goes with this individual sport. There's a lot of delays during a round. It would be pretty penal to just innocently – you know, you drop a ball down, you're on the tee waiting to hit a shot, and you hit a couple chips. I see it both ways. It does look kind of weird that you can work on something like that during a round, but it's a little different game, I guess.
Yeah. And last thing I'll say, and it's kind of along the lines we just mentioned, you know, when we're playing a four, let's call it 4.5 hour round in a competition, but we're playing this 4.5 hour round, you know, less than 28 to 32 minutes of it are actually making a stroke at a ball. So there is a lot of standing around. There's a lot of time to where you could be doing other things, or you could be making a practice stroke. And in those, you know, 3.5 hours, you're not permitted to do that.
Yeah. So. All right, moving on. This is one that you just did a deep dive on, and that was 2013 Tiger's Drop. If you didn't see it, check out the CGA's rules page, and you'll see a great explanation of what happened in 2013. If you missed it because you've been in a cave for the last decade and don't care about the rules at all, Tiger, in his first round, hit the flag stick. Ball ricocheted back into the water on hole 15. And it led to an improper drop that, again, we won't go through all the details. But it basically what ended up happening is he signed an incorrect scorecard. And at the time, the committee, some would say, got I don't know, they gave him a special treatment and they went light on, or they found a loophole. But basically, he signed for an incorrect score. He incurred a two-stroke penalty for dropping in the wrong place. Let's stop there for just a minute. Is that still true today? If I drop in the wrong place, what is the ruling today? Tiger got a two-stroke penalty. Is that still true today?
Well, if you drop in a wrong place, you do have time to correct that mistake on 14.5. Yeah, but so if you play from a wrong place like Tiger did in 2013, you're still going to get the general penalty today. That is one of the five mistakes in stroke play where you're also going to have to correct that mistake from playing from a wrong place. But today you're still just like Tiger did in 2013. Today, if you drop and play from a wrong place, you're still getting two strokes in the general penalty.
So explain how the committee, okay, let's just make sure we're clear on this. So he signed for a score that should have included an additional two penalty strokes. So at the time, and still true today, if you sign for an incorrect score, I'm already losing it. So you signed for, we'll get to this, obviously, preview of coming attractions when we get to the number one, which I think most people know. Mm-hmm. When you sign a scorecard with a score higher than what you actually made, you have to live with the, he signed for a lower score because he didn't include the two stroke penalty.
Correct.
That was a disqualification penalty then. Mm-hmm. It's a disqualification penalty today. Yes or no?
Yes. So even today, if I play in a competition and I signed for a three on a hole where I made a four, I sign that card and I turn it in and those facts become known, I'm still disqualified under, oh man, quoting too many numbers here today, but I believe today it's in rule 3.3 or 3.2.
Okay.
It's part of rule 3 of the competition, but that's still true today. What's not still true today is if we're going back to the old decisions book, we're flipping back in time here because you got to think this is 2013. We're talking about a different set of rules here in 2013 than what we're using today. So the decisions book is still out there. In 2013, decision 33-7 gave the committee of a competition authorization to waive a disqualification penalty. This decision no longer exists as of the revision in 2019 in the rules of golf. That decision was eliminated. What now exists today is essentially wrapped up in rule 1.3. And that authorization for the committee no longer exists. The rules today tell the committee that they have to apply the rules the way they're written, the penalties the way they're written, and penalties to the appropriate breaches of the rules. Giving discretion to the committee to waive a disqualification penalty, that the committee no longer has that authority today. So if Tiger did this same drop today and all factors were the same, right? No other thing was changed. The committee would essentially no longer be able to do that, what they did in 2013. They would have to disqualify him.
Wow. Yeah. So didn't quite, when the rules were redone in 2019, I didn't realize that here you go. I learned something right here exception or so. Speaking of exceptions, so I know it gets more complicated than what you just described, because if a player did not apply a penalty stroke, because this happened. Now we fast forward post 2019. It's happened a few times. I think a good, for instance, was Lexi Thompson, who played from a wrong place. And it must have been after 2019. It might have been in 2019.
It could have been.
And she ended up getting a four-stroke penalty, but she was not disqualified because she signed for a score lower than what she actually took for failure to include penalty strokes. But now, what is the exception which would allow a player to have to live with the higher score but not be disqualified?
So the exception now is, so if a player signs for a scorecard, but there's a failure to include an unknown penalty in the scorecard, then the exception now would be that player just gets that penalty applied to their scorecard.
Right. So that's,
instead of a disqualification, it, as long as a player unknowingly signed the card, or they signed the card with a penalty they unknowingly got or should have applied to that score, that exception kicks in to where the score is retroactively applied, whether it's the next day of the competition or immediately after that card is turned in. The penalty is applied, the player's not disqualified, and then the score stands as it's newly revised.
So to put a bow on Tiger, if that happened today, and let's just give Tiger the benefit of the doubt and say he wasn't cheating, he didn't intentionally, he made a mistake, he didn't know he was dropping in a wrong place. Mm-hmm. I think that's the case. I think he was blending a couple of his different options, which we don't need to go into here. So seems to me he would just had to, we would have ended up with the same result. He still, because then he ended up receiving the two-stroke penalty. So it was almost a preview of coming attractions.
He did. So essentially what the committee did is they waived the disqualification penalty.
But they still gave him two.
They applied a two-stroke
penalty. And today, they wouldn't have to go through the waiving of disqualification. They would have just given him the two.
Correct. Yes. As long as all the criteria comes together and meets that exception of the unknown penalty or unknown applying of the penalty into that score when he signed that card. So the other thing that also kicks in today, and we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but the advent of a relief area in 2019 right. also may have altered how this played out in the modern rules. So we know with Tiger's comments about, you know, he dropped 2 yards or whatever it was, you know, a yard or so back from where he had previously hit because he didn't want to hit the flag stick. And he was, you know, if anyone out there is so dialed into their yardages to where you can drop 2 yards behind where your previous shot was to avoid it happening again, good for you. I'm not that type of player. But
it's only yardage. You have to be pretty accurate, too. I mean, it's distance and aim. Yeah.
But anyways, you know, with that drop, you know, with the advent of our one club length relief area, in some cases too, but with this option, it would have been a one club length relief area. There is a chance that Tiger's drop may have still ended up in that one club length relief area. He says 2 yards, but in reality, was it exactly 6 feet? Was it exactly however many inches 2 yards equates to? I don't know. It could have dropped within that relief area and it could have satisfied, you know, the playing from a wrong place, you know, caveat to that. Now, in terms of him mixing up his options, with the way his ball entered that penalty area and the way it at that time last crossed the margin of the hazard, his back on the line relief, and may have mentioned this in the video I just recently did, his back on the line relief would have been roughly 35 yards to the left of where he dropped.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just by him standing in the place where his old divot was, you know, that was kind of him electing to take that stroke and distance option.
Sure. Right, but I think, again, that he was sort of blending the two, thinking he had some wiggle room. And you do have a little bit of wiggle room now, a lot more than you did then, which I think is a good change because it's a lot more clear than just kind of making it open to interpretation. Okay, we're at number two.
This is one I wasn't super familiar with. So I'll
set it up. And I wasn't familiar with it until years later. When Ken Venturi brought it up, it was sort of written about in a book, and it was kind of this bad blood between Venturi and Palmer. 1958, 12th hole, Palmer hits his shot, tee shot on 12 over the green, ends up in a bad lie. It could be embedded. Again, depending on who you believe, Palmer either A, played the chip shot without saying anything and hold out for double bogey, and then after all that happened, said, I think that ball was embedded. and went back and played a second ball after taking further action, scoring three with that ball, asked for a ruling a couple holes later and was told the score, the par was, he was allowed to play to score with the second ball. According to Venturi, that's how it happened. According to Palmer, again, we will never know. He did declare that he wanted to play a second ball. So again, the time that was rule 3-3, which for those us rule nerds, that's one of the few rules almost every rules nerd could quote because it's so often referenced. Because in the rules, oftentimes the way this the reason the rule is there is because there may or may not be a rules official right there to give you a ruling. So this is a way to keep play moving. Unlikely that would happen today where there'd be nobody there to make a ruling. I think now they have the course pretty well covered. So there's not going to, just like the Ernie Els one we talked about, somebody's going to get called in and make a ruling. So there's no ambiguity. But it was a very dramatic ruling, led to a lot of bad blood. But talk about how this rule has changed. And it's been changed a lot over the years, tweaked, modified. It's a very, very, we almost need to have a dry erase to explain this. But do your best to try to explain playing a second ball when there's doubt.
So going back to the old ruling, so in 1958, this still would have been 3-3 with the way 3-3 was written. And I like the old title of 3-3 better than what it's called in the rule book now. For those familiar with the old rules, rule 3-3 used to be called doubt as procedure in stroke play. Today it's called playing two balls when uncertain what to do. Essentially, they get the same point across.
Well, by the way, just a quick interjection there. That is a great example of the modernization of the rules and translation and written in plain English, because doubt as to procedure is a lot harder to translate into Taiwanese than not sure what to do or whatever.
Yeah. Playing two balls when uncertain what to do. Today the rule, today it's 20.1C3. Under the new rules, in case anyone's curious about how the numbers have changed. But essentially, with both rules, the idea was for players who were in a situation where they weren't sure if a condition applied or if they got relief from something or if a ruling was applicable to their situation, the players have an option to play a second ball in stroke play only. This rule doesn't exist in match play. The players don't have this option in match play, but in stroke play, it essentially gives players the option to play two balls, you know, one to see if, you know, if they get relief from something or if a rule applies, you know, if their ruling doesn't apply, they play the original ball. Also gives a player the option of which ball they would like to count should the rules allow for it. Essentially, at the core of it, you know, the very similar things here. The hinging factor on both of these rules, both 3-3 and the new 20.1C3, is one, the decision to play two balls has to be made when the situation comes up, right? You can't get into a situation, play a ball or play a stroke, and then decide you want to play a second ball. The decision has to be made before any strokes are made and when the situation arises. The other part of it is, you know, the balls have to be played concurrently. You can't play one ball a certain amount of strokes down this way, come back, then take into your second ball, play a certain amount of strokes down this way. The balls must be played concurrently. And so by, you know, in this Arnold Palmer situation, what it sounds like is that one ball was played out to be holed, whether that was the original ball or it sounds like it was the original ball in this case. And then, you know, whether the choice to play that second ball or the first stroke at that second ball was then played after one ball being holed. The way, but even with 3-3 and the way today it's written, you know, that wouldn't be permitted. Once that first ball, if in the case that this was the case, once that first ball would be holed, in Palmer's case, if there was no strokes made at that second ball under 3-3, that first ball would count. He holed it out, that hole is completed, he loses his essentially opportunity to play that second ball under 3-3 in that case. Now, today, you know, again, there's some things that are different with 3-3 and 20.1C3 today. The core of it is the same. If Palmer had done this same situation in 2019 or even in 2020, let's just say Arnold Palmer is still with us today and he's playing the 2020 Masters and embeds his ball behind the 12th green today. If he plays his shot and then decides to invoke 20.1C3, well, he's kind of out of luck there. Once he plays that shot, once he plays that first stroke at a ball before declaring his two ball rule, he's kind of done. He's past the point of no return. That really, that is kind of the hinging thing in both of these rules. It is still
right. And I think for sake of not confusing people, that's a good place to leave this, because you get into what is the original ball. I will just add one other thing. There isn't anything in the rule that says you have to play the balls in a certain order. They need to play concurrently, but you can, and I've found myself in this situation. Let's be honest. If you've invoked the rule properly and you've announced which ball you want to score with, you know which ball you want to score with. And I found myself in this weird situation where the ball I wanted to score with was closer to the hole, no, further from the hole, no, closer to the hole, I'm sorry, from the ball that I didn't want to score with. So you can take it. I thought, can I go ahead and play the ball in out of order to learn, because they're on a very similar line? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. So I guess you look at that and say, there's always going to be wrinkles to a rule that are going to maybe gain you some advantage. I wasn't doing it to manipulate, but it was a weird thing, because I thought, am I obligated to play them in a certain order and therefore not gain an advantage?
So one last thing I'll leave off with playing two balls and stroke play. And 20.1 C3 it's for those who are unfamiliar with it or not really fully understanding it, it's a complicated rule. Mm-hmm. It seems pretty straightforward. You play two balls, you pick which one you want to count, and you play them both out. It seems straightforward, but there's a lot of intricacies to 20.1 C3 that I could talk for another hour on. But the last thing I'll leave out, and this could be a Palmer thing, it still applies today, but in the event that you do play two balls and you don't pick which one you would like to score with, and you just go along and play them, the ball you make a stroke at first, that's going to be the default ball you now are intending to score with. So in Ed's case, if he has two balls and one's further away from the hole and he doesn't announce which ball he would like to count, if he makes a stroke at that ball that's further away from the hole, well, by default under the rule, that's going to now be the one that he intends to count for his score should the rules allow for it.
Right. Well, like I said, it's a complicated. It's been tweaked a lot. I've been in rule seminars and seems like it's one of those things that, like you said, you it's very confusing, but the basics of it are simple. It's a way to resolve something. Mm-hmm. And I actually found out about this rule when I was playing in the CGA Publinks many, many moons ago. And a guy who really knew the rules, my ball was in a rut. I wasn't sure if it should have been marked as grounded into repair. And I thought, I'm just going to be stuck. He said, no. You can play two balls. I looked at him like he had two heads. I said, what do you mean? And he walked me through the rule. And I'm like, what a beautiful thing. So it's there to help you, and you should use it. Okay. This brings us to the number one granddaddy of all rules stories from Augusta National. And this, of course, takes us to 1968. Roberto DiVincenzo famously birdied the 17th hole at the Masters. Obviously at the Masters at Augusta National. Tommy Aaron was his marker. Wrote down a 4, should have written down 3. As a result, he signed for the 4, and he had to live with the results. So we talked about what happens when you sign for a score lower than what you actually made. In this case, he signed for a score higher than what he actually made. As a result of that one stroke, Bob Golby became the Masters champion. Bob Golby, who went on to be a pretty well-known commentator and a pretty good one for television, was a Masters champion. He got to go to the dinners every year. And now, and it's really kind of an unfortunate asterisk. And who knows, Bob Golby, if that didn't happen, there would have been a playoff. And Bob Golby could have very easily won that playoff. He was denied that opportunity sort of to validate his win. And I'm sure if he had it any other way, he would have much preferred to win it on the golf course instead of in the scoring area. To me, so here's my answer to my own question. Would that still be true today? The answer is yes. The rule is no different. However, what would be different, a la Charlie Hoffman, Tommy Aaron, what did he do? He took full responsibility. He said famously, me so stupid or I so stupid, with his broken English being Argentinian. He took full responsibility. He didn't blame anybody. He didn't throw expletives at the Masters. He just said, I made a mistake. He owned his mistake. That would not happen today.
Yeah, it's something that, you see it far and few between today, especially on a level as far as professional golf. And again, like you said, this this would be no different today. If a four was signed instead of a three on the scorecard of the 2022 Masters, it's going to go down as a four and that player is going to live with it. And even with further, you know, rules changes throughout the future, I don't see this changing in any further rules revisions. I think this is going to continue to be the case going forward in the future. Now, there's been exceptions to in part of this rule with, you know, markers failing to carry out their duty with, you know, signing scorecards and whatnot. But bottom line, you know, signing for a higher score is always going to stand. In my opinion, I think it's going to stay. It's that way today. I think it's going to continue to stay that way in the future.
So this is why I love these talks. You're an old soul, Lewis, because I'm kind of a hybrid here. When somebody says to me, bring in other sports, let me get this straight. It's a fact. It's an absolute fact that Tommy Aaron made a three on that score, on that hole. It's a fact. We saw it. It was on television. He did it. How ridiculous is it that because of a clerical error, we don't just say he made it? So I happen to disagree. I think that the rules will bend and will accommodate for this type of administrative clerical error. And again, you can go to, look, let's talk, and this is a stretch maybe by analogy. When you look at information that becomes known because of video replay, because of a super zoom lens, we have video evidence that showed the player scored that. And we're going to ignore that evidence. The world saw it, and we're going to ignore it because of somebody's, you know, just putting down the wrong shape number on a scorecard. So I just think that that's going to have to change. I actually, you know, because again, I'm speaking on both sides of this, because as I just said, as we introduced this, I love the fact that in golf you take responsibility. I love the fact that Roberto DiVincenzo had to live with that mistake and that he took responsibility. That is such a great message for all of us. Life isn't fair. Golf isn't fair. Take responsibility. This is a value that seems to be becoming extinct. So I love that. On the other hand, I get it. You know, in this world of fairness, how is that fair? So it'll be interesting to see what the rulemakers do, if anything, on this.
Well, I've always equated it to, you know, in this scenario where a four is signed instead of a three, I've always equated that one stroke as kind of a dummy penalty. Mm-hmm. You know, there's two sides to the scorecard. There's two lines. There's one for a contestant. There's one for a marker. There has to be two signatures on that card when it gets turned in. And both signatures have to look at those numbers. And if you're that much of a dummy to not look at the numbers before you sign it, well, maybe you should have to live with it. And maybe I'm taking a little bit of a hard-nosed approach at it. But yeah, as we wrap up here, I'll tell one real quick story. I was the 18th hole scorer at the LPGA ShopRite down in New Jersey for 2 years. And for the 2 years, I was the scorer there on the 18th hole when the players would come into the tent, turn their cards in. There was always one particular player that would take roughly 20 minutes to turn her card in because she wanted to look at the numbers on her scorecard over and over and over again. And whoever her marker was for that round would just, you know, come on, like the numbers are right. You know, Paula Creamer was the player. Give her name up that way. But I always thought it was funny that she would do that. And I guarantee you that Paula Creamer has never signed an incorrect scorecard. Yeah. She's probably never signed for a number higher than she actually made. So I don't know. This is one where I see both sides, but I still lean heavily towards one.
Well, and I just think it's the other absurdity, as some would say, in this rule is that why do we wait until 4.5 hours later to do the tallying? Why don't we do it on the spot when there's going to be very little doubt? I actually was in a similar story real quick, the U.S. Senior Open. I don't remember the player. He sat in there for 20 minutes because he flat out could not remember what he scored on the ninth hole. And he just wasn't going to sign until he could somehow. Now, again, I guess that's why it was the Senior Open. He had a senior moment, could not remember. Now, I guarantee you, if you'd asked him when he walked off the ninth green, he probably would have remembered what he scored. So in his defense, I think that this is a part of the game that is ripe for modernization. it seems like there's this is, if you're going to change one thing, it's just completely outdated. It would be this. So as we wrap up, fun talk, Spirit of the Game, episode 4, or whatever we're on. Tell me about your master's sweater. So I'm sitting here with Lewis. I'm going to describe it. First of all, it's a really cool plum color. And he's got a master's logo on the left chest. And it's the master's logo with a circle around it. And that's, it's I'm guessing that that is only the members get that logo. Is that true? And how the hell did you get that shirt?
You would be correct. This particular quarter zip was not purchased from a merchandise building at Augusta National. This particular quarter zip I purchased from the actual golf shop at Augusta National.
How did you get in there? How did you work this
well,
deal?
Finagled my way in there would be the correct terminology. But 2019, I was part of the Drive-Thru Putt National Finals team of section employees that would go down there. So every year, 12 sections would get chosen to send one employee to the Drive-Thru Putt National Finals. I was chosen in 2019 to go down there and represent my Philadelphia section, which I was a member of at the time. And, you know, we did the whole, you know, all the stuff with dry trip and putt. And on the Sunday after dry trip and putt, I wanted to get my merchandise that day because I didn't want to deal with it on the Monday practice round. I didn't want to carry it around. I wanted to just grab it after dry trip and putt was over, take it back to my hotel room and just pack it away and be done with it.
Yeah.
Dry trip and putt, if anyone's familiar with it, it ends early afternoon. It takes place in the morning, but it ends early afternoon. So we ended about 2 o'clock, but long story short, I didn't have enough time. I didn't leave myself enough time to go to the merchandise building that day to get it. I'll drop another fact. I was instead enjoying my lunch in the Augusta National Clubhouse.
Oh, nice.
So I took too much time enjoying my lunch in the clubhouse to go to the merchandise building. So I ran out of time. And as I was walking on my way back to the bus to get to go back to the clubhouse for the rest of the
bus
session.
Why weren't you? I mean, it sounds like you were like VIP.
Should have been. I should have grabbed a shuttle. But with the rest of the section employees back to the hotel, I ran into an acquaintance of mine. His name is Charlie Schuyler. He was most recently the director of golf at Saucon Valley Country Club, host of this year's U.S. Senior Open. Okay. Prior to that, he was an assistant at Augusta National Golf Club. So I got to talk to Charlie. I was like, hey, you know, Charlie, thanks for everything, blah, blah, blah. Good to see you this week. And he was asking me, he's like, oh, where are you coming from? Where are you going? I was like, oh, you know, I was just coming from the merchandise building, but it closed. I didn't have a chance to go to it today. I'm just going to catch my ride back to the hotel now. He's like, well, hold on. Maybe I can do something for you. So we walk, you know, over here. We walk kind of down in between a building, down a, you know, a sidewalk. And, you know, we get to the end, lo and behold, we're right in front of the golf shop. You know, it's, if anyone's familiar with the golf shop, it's right off of the clubhouse. You know, when you got the main clubhouse, it's right off of there. And, you know, he flashes his badge to the security guy and he says, help yourself. So walk into the golf shop. It's a very small golf shop. During Masters Week, it's a little bit different. It's set up a little bit different, but the gist of it is the same as if you would go there on any other week. So I, you know, did some shopping. Everyone in there, by the way, it's as small of a golf shop it is, they have at least no more than or no less than 12 employees working in that golf shop. You almost have a personal shopping attendant with you when you're in there. But I did my shopping. I spent my undisclosed amount in that golf shop. I do have several items with the Augusta National.
You can't buy that logo. Only in the golf shop can you buy that logo. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So if you go to any of the merchandise buildings, you go to the main one, or if you go to the secondary merchandise building off of the fifth hole now that they've built it, you can only buy the Masters Tournament logo in those merchandise buildings. Right. So as far as I know, the members golf shop is the only place that you can buy.
So this is why we need to be on video so everybody can see that beautiful logo. So, well, that's a wrap. Thanks for sharing that story. We'll be back again whenever we feel like it for another edition of Spirit of the Game.
All right, till then.